You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a lockdown.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, band.video, vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We appreciate your amazing and continued support. You can go to the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Macroaggression, where I argue with robots. Legal Shield has been one of our newest sponsors. Thank God. They've been in business for 50 years. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. They're available in the United States and Canada. And what they do is that it's the collective buying power of all of us directed towards high-powered law firms in your area. It gives you access to an attorney at a very reasonable rate. How reasonable? Well, like $30 a month. So to get you in the door, get you all your legal documents taken care of, your will, last will and testament, your medical directive, your financial power of attorney, all those things that if you don't have them, the state gets involved in your affairs. And God knows we have no love for the state at this show. So get them out of the way. Get that stuff taken care of. You don't want to spend a couple grand on it, but you're going to have to unless you have Legal Shield, which will allow you to knock that out in the first month. Just go ahead and get it taken care of and then keep the service. And in the future, if your work wants you to sign some weird contract that includes some language about medical procedures that you are signing up to be on board with, you send all that stuff to your attorney. If you get a parking ticket, a speeding ticket, or whatever, send it to your attorney. Somebody says they ruin your shirt at the dry cleaners and tell you too bad. Send that. Have your attorney send a letter. I do ask this though. I do request this from everybody. Only use this power for good, not evil. Do not use this to threaten people that haven't done anything to you. But if you feel like you're getting pushed around by somebody, stand up for yourself. That's why we created the web domain www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. You can go there and find out everything that Legal Shield is doing. It allows you to level the playing field here. If you're getting audited by the IRS for your W-2, you have access to lawyers that can help you out with this. The average attorney you'll be dealing with has 22 years of experience. So you're not going to get somebody fresh out of law school. You'll get a good person that knows what they're doing and how to navigate this system. It's easy for them. It's tough for us. I mean, we look at this stuff and you know, the legal documents and whatnot. This is what they do. So now you have representation in a way that was unavailable to you probably before. Go to the website, read up about it, see if it's right for you. If you carry a gun, if you have a small business and need a legal department, they've got access to that. If you need Identity Shield, just go to don'tgetpushedaround.com, read up about it, see what you think. Also, Chemical Free Body has been with us since the beginning. They're making the best supplements out there. They're making the supplements that actually work, aren't the ones that you just, you know, that just pass right through your system. God knows the vitamin industry is about the scammiest one you can get involved in. And Chemical Free Body is fantastic. Tim James has been, he's insane about the purity of his products. He is so insane. He asked me to put him in touch with a company that would do his merchandise, his shirts. He asked if they had an organic option. I said, I don't think so. He said, well, then I can't use it. I can't have anything that's synthetic. I've got to have organic cotton for my shirts. He's crazy about his shirts. Just think how crazy he is about what goes into his products. And if you don't like them, he has a double your money back price guarantee. So, I mean, listen, he puts his money behind it. It's getting ready to warm up here. You might be looking to go to the beach. Maybe you want to clean out a little bit. They have a detox in the box bundle. Get that. That'll lean you out. It certainly did with me. Go to chemicalfreebody.com. Use the promo code MACRO. Save yourself a little bit of money and see what you think. Well, this one's going to be fun. I can already tell this one's going to be fun. I've got one of my favorite people out there, Johnny Vedmore from Unlimited Hangout. If you haven't been reading his work, first of all, how dare you? And second of all, it's not late. It's not too late. You got to get on involved in this. He has got what is described as the Black Hand series. We're going to talk about the original Jeffrey Epstein. So without further ado, check out this sweet bastard over there, Johnny Vedmore. How are you, man? Good to see you again.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me back, man. It's so weird because I completely forgive you, everybody, for not knowing my work, because I mean, we live in a time of great censorship, unbelievable censorship. And as soon as I started breaking through with my work, it was always targeted at the people who were censoring. So it was always hard, and I've had like this really uphill struggle, and I don't really care about my crowd size per se, the amount of followers I have or that sort of thing, because all of my work is really written to be able to be read at any point throughout time. The points that they make and the history that they show will not change. They will only get closer. And they will only get closer, because what I'm studying and what I study, for people who don't know me, is the elites, the establishment, how it works, the organizations like intelligence organizations and the mafia, and how they historically they all merge together to create all of these different organizations that we know that rule basically everything from the Council on Foreign Relations to Bilderberg to the WEF. And of course, I focused in on some of these really big characters like Klaus Schwab that no one really knew the history of. And you know, I've had this really beautiful journey, and this is why I've shared this journey with some very loyal readers, some people who have been there with me the entire time. And if one day my work goes ooh, and everybody reads it and I'm really popular, it's the people I shared like this work with originally who really just like, you know, came back and said, wow, what you're doing needs to be done. Keep going, go further, go better, go harder, understand what you're doing is right, and keep on this path. Those people are the people who have like driven me forward. So now I'm just on this journey, and we talked about this slight bit before. It's just like you're propelled not only by that, not only by the positives you get, the positive love you get in return, but the actual feeling of discovering information for the first time, which is kind of like druggish, you know, it has that sort of effect of euphoria where you just realize sometimes I've gone to go to bed and I'm going to be up for, because I've discovered something. The Black Hand series was like this. What we're going to discuss today is the fifth article in a series which was so really massively important for me to write, because as soon as I discovered something, I was propelled into knowing more until it's got to this stage. And that's how this work works. So I'm really happy to have people listening. I'm really happy that people read, and everybody's much forgiven if they haven't read my work. And please, if you do read my work, enjoy, take it in. All I'm doing is putting facts that existed once upon a time down on paper. I am a conduit for information, and that's what we do. This is what we do.
You're going to, if you read the work. Someone asked me recently, where do I go for good information on events that I won't get anywhere else? And I said, go to The Last American Vagabond and go to Unlimited Hangout. And you're going to read articles about things that are, you're going to read them about a year in advance, 6 months to a year in advance before they're even talked about elsewhere. And you're going to feel like you're living, like you've gone into some sort of time machine where you're reading about the future. But it's just that everybody else has to kind of catch up to you guys. When I want the goods on a particular person or a particular angle, that's where I go to look first, because inevitably you guys have done it. But I also have to be careful, because when I go there, this is the problem I had with writing the other books. There were some people that I had to stop listening to while I was writing the book, not because they weren't good, but because they were too good. I didn't want them to influence my writing. So, so if I'm going to be working on a book on a particular topic,
okay,
I have to almost like avoid your stuff, because it's so good that it would be, I kind of want to discover it on my own. You know what I mean?
I completely dig what you're saying in a way that is just like that connects with me completely. And what I do, one of the things I do is, and I, this sometimes I think I risk stepping on some people's toes, because I, for instance, with the Welcome 5 article I did, I didn't read anybody else's stuff about it. I avoided reading anything because I don't want to pick up people's opinions.
Right.
I don't want to pick up people's rightful anger. You know, people are angry about something and maybe they don't mean to, but when you read something and you can hear their voice in the background telling you that they're angry within the piece, you feel, you know, you're going to go away with a kind of a different view than you would if you just emotionlessly stick down that information on the table and get rid of that emotion for the subject and for the topic. And I keep going through this process where what I discovered is, like, the first 2 days of working on any subject, I get really angry and pissed off, and I'm like looking at the screen, I'm going, yeah, come on, I'm gonna fight somebody. And then all I pass by all of that, and then suddenly I'm just going to put down all of the information. I won't put in anything that I cannot back up, prove, source. That is just my opinion. I will save that for right at the end of an article, where I'll give you like the reader a basic opinion about what I think may be happening. But usually all I want to do is get that information down, and you can't look at it with emotion. If you look at it with emotion, you will get angry every time, and you will always make the wrong decisions of where you look for the next thing, because we have a habit habit of humans of making bad people into even worse people, and then making worse people into even worse people. And that's done by our anger, where in actual reality, every human's capable of the same amount of good and evil. It depends about the amount of persuasion that they can put forward onto people to make other people do things that are negative. And you've got to take it each person as they go. And even these elites are blind in a world that they don't see what the other half lives like. They don't know what it's like to be in some run-down estate in somewhere like Leicestershire or somewhere like Colville, in a big block of towers where you've got 15 kids living in a three-bedroom house. They don't understand like some of the harsh realities that other people live by. So why would we understand theirs? And we can understand why we get crossed wires. But at the end of the day, they're trying to manipulate, create a world that's in their image. And that's what we're trying to expose, is what their image actually looks like.
And nobody does it better than you. I mean, you really brought that to the table with the Wellcome Trust stuff. I mean, I left that thinking, we've got the makings of a medical world government being run by people that have no, that are trying to fast track vaccines and make them in 100 days, you know? Yeah. And like, oh, it's just computer code. We'll just email it to each other, you know? And I'm looking at this and I'm going, lockdowns, World Economic Forum connected, you know, completely insulated from reality, an underlying theme always of depopulation and eugenics. And I see that, I go, well, this has got to be like, everybody's got to know who Wellcome Trust is. Everybody's got to know about this, right? Right. Mm-hmm. I look around, who's who? There are very few people doing work on it. You're one of them. Yeah. And I read your work and I went, we have to talk. And that was what, a year and a half ago?
It's all about noise. You know, everybody looks at a situation, they try and take in as much information as possible. You know, like people who don't do what we do, their research is going on to say YouTube or Rumble or whatever, or Odyssey, and they're clicking around and they're typing in the things that they think will give them that information, but they're only getting part the information, and there's so much noise. Every single bit of information they get comes with 100 to 150 bits of information that are useless, and alleyways and routes that you could go, and places that are going to lead you nowhere, lead people nowhere. And what we do, what I try and do with my work, is take away all of that noise. So take away all of the missteps and the misdirections, and narrow it down to who's really responsible for doing certain things. And I think in the grand scheme of the vaccine thing, there's so much noise, you know, there's so many people shouting and screaming, so many bad actors, but lots of those bad actors work for the same few actors. And once we're able to see who those guys are, those are the guys who we really officially need to take out of the policy making machine that they've created to stop them. But I mean, monster anyway, so what can we do?
Well, let's talk about the original Jeffrey Epstein, shall we? This is a guy named George Huntington Hartford II. And when you're born with a name like that, I suppose you're predisposed to be a tremendous asshole. And certainly this guy was. His family comes from the A&P stores, right? So this is a family fortune. A&P is not a big deal here anymore, but I think it was for a long, long time. It was, if I'm not mistaken, I remember you writing that it was the first chain of grocery stores. Is that right?
Yeah. It was the first ever like kind of chain grocery idea behind a store. And it was, it captured a massive market really early on doing that. No one else had done that. So it's like when you first, it's like any big bubble that suddenly goes, boom, there's a load of people right at the beginning who make loads of money and get out of it really quickly and go, yeah, and dance away. Well, they kept trying. I think you could say probably for 50, 60 years, they were probably on top in that sort of field until they had enough competitors around. But yeah, A&P groceries, which is something we don't have over here, of course. So.
Yeah, we don't have them where I live, but I have seen them before. I think it's maybe a little bit more of an East East Coast thing. But what, let's put this in perspective. What type of fortune are we talking about in maybe today's standards? Are we talking about a family that was worth $1 billion?
I think they would probably be something like top 10 richest people of that time. They were like, in America, they were really top dog. It made them a load of money really quickly. And it was a fortune. I think it was like, when he inherited his fortune, it was something like 90 billion or something like that. And that's insane. Also, I maybe it was 90 million and then reverted it to billions, but I can't believe how much it was when I researched it. And I have trouble with these sort of things when I see statistics that I still later on, even after I've written it down, sourced it later on, I go back. I'm like, I can't believe the figure. The figure is so grand. It makes no sense. But he had a lot. He had a lot of money. He was a billionaire. And he it was a bit weird because the, his grandfather's the one who created this. He kind of like, got into the company, this AMP grocery stores. He bought into the company and then he created into something else and bought everybody out. And so basically he owned everything and had loads and loads and loads and loads of money. And when he died, it seems he hated his children and he had the will skip over his children. And there was probably a reason. George Huntington Hartford's father was, I can't remember what his name is now, but he was notoriously, Edward Huntington Hartford. He was a terrible arsehole of the highest degree, and he hated everybody. He spent like the end of his life alone, and he died by the time Huntington Hartford was 11 years old. And his Huntington Hartford sister Josephine Bryce later said, you know, I don't think Hunt even knew who he was, really. Like, you know, it was so distant from him. And it really stunted George Huntington Hartford the second. Of course, his grandfather was George Huntington Hartford the first. And when his grandfather died, I think it was in 1921, he inherited all of this fortune. And him and his sister inherited some. And of course, it was some other around the family, but it was such a massive amount of money. And he would, I mean, it's a kind of like, I like to tell stories like this in a Romeo and Juliet fashion by telling you the end first, because he's going to lose nearly every single bit of that money. I mean, this is the fun of the story and the thrill of the chase when you're going through the life of George Huntington Hartford II. He is going to waste all of this massive fortune, a fortune that to us is completely impossible to imagine. His sister, Josephine Bryce, Josephine Huntington Hartford, she would marry into with someone really successful, and she would still maintain quite a fortune. But George Huntington Hartford the second, he was a boy.
Well, he. When you examine his real estate holdings, it is understandable why you could make a comparison that he very, very much was another Jeffrey Epstein. We've got Palm Beach, New York City, France, an island, Hog Island in the Bahamas. He's got a place in London. He's got a place in Jersey. He's got a place in Hollywood. So he's got the requisite island in the Caribbean to do God knows what. He's got the Palm Beach estate. He's got the New York apartment. He's got all the, he's got
the look. He even looks a little bit like Jeffrey Epstein. It's quite amazing. You see, as well as that, he's got all of the character traits, especially with the age range of girls he found attractive.
Yeah.
And the way that he would get those girls. It's quite a fantastic, because You go back to when his around the time his dad died, like Hunting and Hartford's, like there's these stories about Hunting and Hartford still being fed by his mother when he's like 11 years old. They're around the dinner table and she's cutting up his meat in public and feeding it in his mouth. And he's like, nom, nom. And he goes to school and he has these terrible experiences with all these horrible bullies who treat him so badly and whatever. He's from New Money, you know, they see him as New Money, even though he's like, what, 50 years old, the fortune's 50 years old or something. Maybe.
Yeah, that's New Money to them, right?
Yeah, to them, the New Money. You're only old money if you can't remember how far back, how many lines back it goes. Like, he's gone too far. Like, but yeah, he's New Money. So they bully him terribly, has this terrible time, torturous. He's obviously like a bit of a baby in his head. And when he gets out and goes to Harvard, he really starts to look like he's going to burst away. And he does. He kind of like, I would think that anybody with that amount of money can get into Harvard. It's not too hard. They just throw a bit here or a bit there. So I don't think he was very intellectual. He did English literature, if I remember, but I don't think he was very good at anything he ever did. I would put that down probably to even like making milk. I would think he would spill the milk over his hand and he would try and drive and just drive straight off the edge of a cliff. I mean, he was really just everything he did was bad. And he obviously wanted to run away from his mum. He obviously had been given a mother complex by this overbearing mother who was overbearing. She was a very interesting woman, broke down and cried once he ran off with his first wife, Mary, I think her name was Mary Lee Epping. And she was a very run-of-the-mill, I think she was a pharmacist's daughter or something like that. She's described, you know how they describe things in newspapers. And she ended up being like, you know, ended up walking around in elite society. And then, if I remember correctly, she runs off with Douglas Fairbank.
Right. And then he turns up later in some sort of seedy, like
sex orgy stuff he's going on in it too.
Yeah.
Knee deep. There's not only knees he's deep in. They're deep in some stuff. And this, you know, he starts sailing around the place, trying to sail to the Bahamas all the time. Obviously, they've already got some land or something over there, or he just has an affinity with it. So there's a lot of, like, in the 30s, there's a lot of him going backwards and forwards. And then, of course, the war happens, and in the war, these type of rich guys became heroes during the war by, I'm donating use of this estate to the whatever Air Force, or and so I'm a wonderful person, aren't I? And everybody goes, yeah, so he's been donated by, so there's a couple of those things pop up, but there's nothing too much. And it's really in the 50s where he's obviously like desperate to get out and be known and be successful. Everything's just, you know, he's just, I think he's defined by all of his many failures. And he sees himself as just a big fail. So he meets a woman around this time who's his second wife. And she's a young girl. I think she's about 17, and she says selling cigarettes in Vero's nightclub or somewhere like that. And he buys all his cigarettes off her, you know, charms her by buying all the cigarettes in it. And she's going out with Charlie Chaplin's son. Charlie Chaplin is another one who hangs around in all of these like seedy orgy clubs later, but the clubs surrounding him rather than the orgies themselves. He's around all of that crew. The people who are attending the orgies all know Charlie Chaplin quite well, and he's attending like high society London stuff by the 60s and 70s, up to the point where I think it's like the people who eventually like set up the Claremont Club all know him as well. So he gets around in these elite circles. Obviously, right. He's every man hero is Charlie Chaplin. But yeah, Charlie Chaplin's son, Charlie Chaplin actually persuades the girl to go with George Huntington Hartford II and leave his son, yeah. Which is quite amazing. This woman was a woman who went by the name Marjorie Steele. Marjorie Steele was an actress at the time. She wasn't very good because obviously she was working selling cigarettes in a in a nightclub. So, you know, she wasn't getting much attention. And then she meets this billionaire who then starts writing scripts for her and starts trying to put her, like obviously producing movies that she can be in. And he's basically so desperate to make something succeed that he's just doing everything by the 50s. He's pushing himself out. George Huntington Hartford is trying, but all of this time, he's got his people going looking for young girls because even though he's married, he's a terrible cheat. Mary Lee Epping left him because he had had a child out of wedlock with some other young girl. And he, as is quoted later, and is what I mentioned about the commonality with Jeffrey Epstein, he liked his girls prime, they said.
Yeah.
So he liked them really young. Mariella Novotny, when she was a beautiful 18-year-old, just ex-chorus girl, really slim and etc., was too old for him. Yikes. So that is really like a sign of George Huntington Hartford II. And he was so desperate to succeed. So desperate. I can't remember around the time it was. I mean, they had lots of different. I think he produced a version of, if I remember right, Jane Eyre or something. I can't quite remember, but it was one of the classic sort of period pieces he tried to produce. And Marjorie Steele ended up like leaving that and getting out of there. The first time I had come across George Huntington Hartford when I was researching wasn't finding him originally. Like I say, it's the fifth in the article. The first time I'd come across him, he was in the Montrose Club in the UK. Now, I went to where the Montrose Club was and filmed it for one of the news hounds to kind of like get the feeling. And I mean, I've got to know all of the characters here so well. But that was how I got into researching this in the first place, because of course Whitney Webb said to me, can you find out about the craze and this London nightclub Esmeralda's Barn and who else who went with it and etc. And I went and researched Esmeralda's Barn, and Esmeralda's Barn was created by a woman called Esmeralda Goulart. Esmeralda Noel Smith was a married name, but she got divorced in 1947, still used it in some of the highbrow places. But Esmeralda was a really interesting woman, owned a few clubs, and one of the clubs, and sitting around a table on the night that Huntington Hartford and Marjorie Steele was there with Pietro Anagoni, Esmeralda would have been sitting around the table when they when I first come across him. The first come across George Huntington Hartford when he's signing his signature. And it turned out Marjorie Steele was a master a forger, so she could forge a signature. And Pietro Anagoni, who frequented all of these nightclubs in London that these guys hung around in, he was the guy who was painting the portrait of Queen Elizabeth II at the time. He painted two portraits of Queen Elizabeth II. So obviously they liked him. They liked Pietro Anagoni. He comes up in a few different parts of this piece. And he was also a master forger. And George Huntington Hartford wrote down his signature, and then Marjorie and Pietro did their forgeries. And then no one round the dinner table could tell whose signature was real. And, you know, the reason I go back to that, that's the first time that I come across George Huntington Hartford. And it was very interesting because the more I got to learn about him, the more that said quite a lot more. It was like, it's kind of emblematic of him. It's like his signature was so weak that it could be faked. His right. life. His way he was, he could not achieve anything. Even when you look at the signature, it's like, well, you wouldn't even actually need to be a master forger to do that. So it's not such an amazing. But first, I was like, oh, that's an amazing story. And when the second time I come across George Huntington Hartford, he's in an orgy and he's talking about how to get really young girls, and I'm just like, who? Who's this guy? And what's he doing hanging around? Like, why is no one phone? What, he's a billionaire. He's extremely rich. He's an elite. And I don't know who he is. And kind of like really interesting how he pops up in these little places and he's constantly looking for young girls and doing all of this stuff. So through the '50s, he was doing all of that. Eventually, later on, people involved in the Profumo scandal, the people who were hanging around with Mary Ellen and Botany and Horace Divin and some of my more favorite people from the Profumo affair, which was like the led to the downfall of the British government. Mary Ellen Botany and Horace Divin, who I mentioned, were really important in getting Mary Ellen Novotny into JFK's bedchambers, and she had to get smuggled out of America as well. She was nearly involved in the downfall of the American government just as he had been put in charge as president, and just before he had actually become president, you know, when he had elected between that stage. Right. He's such interesting people he's hanging around with, and he has Stephen Ward, who's all of their friend. He's the guy who ends up being the patsy for the Profumo affair, gets taken out after overdose in a trial that is just sensational and brings down the British government. I mean, oh yeah, you know, Mr. Suicide and taken out on a stretcher, and you could put in Stephen Ward's stretcher, you can see the pictures, and it's like oh, it's another Epstein moment, you know. There's lots of that revolving around here, and Stephen Ward is so interesting. Stephen Ward, society osteopath, he was known as. Well, Stephen Ward was also a fantastic portrait drawer. He could really smack out, give him a pencil, give him a piece of paper and a pad, and boom, he's created the most fantastic portrait of someone, and everybody loves him. He was such a tart. He was a tart with everybody, and he used to sleep around the place. A really interesting character. He once drew a picture for George Huntington Hartford II of a girl on a flying machine being pleasured, a self-pleasuring flying machine. Some sort of dildo flying machine. that George Huntington Hartford loved and gave off to someone, one of his close friends. And he eventually got Stephen Ward to be his Ghislaine Maxwell. So George Huntington Hartford eventually got Stephen Ward to go out to the streets of London when he was in London and pick up young girls who were prime for him. Anyone who's a 14, 15, 16, 17, around that time, you know, go out, Stephen Ward. Stephen Ward, sketch pad in hand. It says in one of the books I read about him, sketch pad in hand, goes out to get these girls. It's just an extraordinary story that has so many similarities. But what's weird about this, and what the adventure is about the Black Hand series in general, is that where I call Huntington Hartford the real Jeffrey, or the original Jeffrey Epstein, in actual fact, a load of different characters involved in that whole scandal, involved in that whole like circle, have little tiny bits of characters from loads of different people who have been involved in all of the sex compromise operations that have ever existed. And some of them have like Jeffrey Epstein traits. Well, you can see it. You can see it. And you realize, well, you can profile these things and you can work out what type of characters these are and where they fit on like criminal profiling. But they're all criminals.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting thing because they're all criminals.
The connection to... You mentioned that they all bring take a little bit from each of them, put them together, and you've got a Jeffrey Epstein. I wonder about the spying component in Ian Fleming, because mm-hmm. he shows up in this.
Yeah, yeah.
Connected in through Jamaica, through GoldenEye, his resort there, or his house there. And he's got a connection, and everybody who knows about Ian Fleming, for those that don't know, he wrote the James Bond series, was most definitely a spy in his own right. How does he fit into this whole group?
It's quite amazing because it seems to be like happenstance. There was a man named Ivor Bryce, a very interesting man from a wealthy family himself.
Film producer guy?
Yeah, yeah. And in World War One, when he was about 11 years old, he went down to Cornwall. They were escaping the Zeppelin attacks over London during World War One. And so a lot of the rich people, fearing fire, sent their kids off or took them to a resort. And Ian Fleming was, and some of his family and friends were on this beach that Ivor Bryce turned up at, and they became lifelong friends. They went to, they opened like, they did a publishing, a little bit of a publishing company before Second World War together. They went to school together in Eton, which is like, you know, where the establishment yeah. goes. So they were both high born types, you know, and Ivor Bryce and Ian Fleming would really, really, really form a tight relationship. Really, really, a weird sort of like fascist tinted sort of magazine that they set up before World War II. It was very sympathetic to fascista sort of causes, and yet during World War II, they really both get heavily involved in intelligence. They both become, their roles as spies are really like quite grand. Ivor Bryce is, I looked for this, I found this, but I still can't quite, like, how is this? Ivor Bryce is apparently the only British person to ever be serving in the OSS. So there was no one, there was no British people in the OSS, and Ivor Bryce was in the OSS.
Interesting.
So they had this, like, he had this special relationship. Ivor Bryce had a special relationship, and his job by MI6, given to him by MI6, was to turn America against its close neighbors, really. So he was a really naughty boy, and he was focused a lot of the time on places like Cuba. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to turn these people against. Now, Cuba comes up multiple times in this investigation. And this is like pre-1960s Cuba. This is running up to that. There was another guy in another part of the article, Andre Gabor, Tihama Bozomeni, who also has a couple of links to Cuba that I found interesting. I think there was on a embassy level, a meeting with the ambassador, etc. And I think there was a lot of effort at that time to, and it was well documented, to create trouble between America and some of its communist leading neighbors. And these were all like operations that were run that kind of dribbled on after World War II. And though it was really complicated, it sounds really complicated, a lot of what they did, like Ivor Bryce, one of the things he did, research was he made this map, and it was a map showing the location of Nazi sites that were being based in Cuba, like the missile crisis, like, you know, there's missile bases in Cuba, you know, years before, oh, there's Nazi camps where the Nazis are going to attack America from. Mm-hmm. And they tried to pull that same, like, they pulled it before it was pulled, you know. These are the guys who are creating the game. They're creating spymanship and modern spy games. They're really, really going out of their way to do something really special. And they put this map handcuffed to a dead body that they disguise as some sort of pilot, like Nazi pilot or something, and then allow other people to bring it in. And so the Americans will think that the Nazis are planning to do this in Cuba, and then they'll turn against Cuba. And what happened? They did exactly that. The plan worked perfectly. So these people, some of the quotes, I mean, the people they work, because they work with the BSC, which is like this unit that was like a spy, almost like an openly obvious intelligence unit working out in New York during the World War and after. And people like Ernst Cuneo, who was also involved with Fleming and Bryce in creating James Bond eventually, he gave evidence. I think he was giving evidence to Congress or someone about that period. They just admitted they did everything. They did every sort of nasty method to get what they wanted. They did, because that's what the game was. And it was before the rules had properly been written to this like post-World War II spy game era. The Cold War era was like no holds, and there was no rules at the beginning. It was all really messy. And then people realized, oh God, that's caused a load of friction. Let's all like retreat in a little bit and be bit more careful. And then it's like everybody's watching each other and they're panicking. And then it's like this thing where everybody goes into the shadows. And really, that's what I documented within all of these articles. And how I found people like George Huntington Hartford II was going into the shadows, because the shadows back then, there were only limited places where you could go and do drops and information drops, dead letter drops, or whatever they used to call them in London. And London was like a really important place during the Cold War. I mean, yeah. you're, it's the bridge to Europe, you know, it's, you're looking out over there and you're seeing Europe, and you know, the Cold War is like the wall, the Soviet wall is approaching you more and more. And, you know, the Americans on the other side all safe and looking at Britain and saying, what's going on there? I know, send some more guys over there and we'll try and work out what's going on there. And the people over there saying, we'll send some more guys. So all of these nightclubs in London that I started researching, they were just all full of spies walking around. People like Stephen Ward was like this happy-go-lucky Belmondo chic, wearing sunglasses in the nighttime type of smoozer, who is a sharp, like, sexy kind of guy who went around chatting up women. You see, even if you, I was telling someone, when you find out about what Stephen Ward was like as a lover, he wasn't like, you know, what you'd expect. He liked it, could connect with energy, like to lay next to a girl and connect with energy. Most of the girls were like, he didn't necessarily want sex. He was not that type. He just wanted to connect. He seemed like a really nice guy. He seemed like everybody would like him, and he liked that. He liked being the center of it. And all of these people who suddenly had billionaires coming up to him and saying, hey, you, get me a woman off the street and I'll give you this or I'll give you that. Stephen Ward was at the center of that. He had some really, like, Avril Harriman is one of the people that he came across, just happened to be the osteopath for. There's loads of really strange things with Stephen Ward. A lot of the portraits he painted in person include people like Prince Philip, who's, of course, husband to the king. Queen, sorry. Well, who knows? we are in clown world. I mean,
they did hang out with Mountbatten quite a bit.
Yeah. So well, Mountbatten's in all of this circle as well.
Of course he is.
It's a crazy sex scene. And George Huntington Hartford, to get back to George, good old George, he was of course, related eventually to Ivor Bryce, because it was his brother-in-law, because Josephine Huntington Hartford II married Ivor Bryce, and suddenly George Huntington Hartford II, I think he got to be like a bit of a spy. Finally, he got to do something that certain people would know that he's really cool. And that, I think, gave him some sort of like solace. And he, around that time, it's when he sets up, like, buys part of Hog Island, and then goes to and buys an even bigger part, and basically buys the whole island, and renames it Paradise Island. And at this point, what you see is George Huntington Hartford, his marriage to Marjorie Steele is like 1959, 1960. His marriage to Marjorie Steele is failing. He's cheating around all over the place. He wants to be, you know, feel big again. And so he's going to open Paradise Island and invite, I think it's 2,000 of the biggest elites with planes from coming all from all over, to attend. And really, if you look at it, it's like what you'd expect to see in James Bond. And that was being created by those people at that time. They were actually like writing parts of that, because at the same time, Xanadu Productions was being created by Ivor Bryce and Ian Fleming and others in another Caribbean island, where they were trying to persuade the guys, hey, you know, give us a massive amount of tax breaks and we'll bring all of this film production to you. And so they had Ian Fleming writing the first drafts out there, based out on the islands. So it was, you know, it was just a short fly on a light aircraft from Josephine Hunterton Hartford and Ivor Bryce's island to George Hunterton Hartford's Paradise Island. Paradise Island with the P as the flag, and you know that he's a pederast. So it's just, you wonder, was it just that he was like laughing at everybody and being like, I like your young daughters, come to my island, I know you will. Yeah. It failed, mind you. George's plans to open up this massive island failed really badly. He basically had a 52-bedroom hotel on the island, and it wasn't enough to bring in people. People would have to be flown out all of the time, so it wasn't going to make any money. He had there was a nearby casino, and in about, I think it was about 1963, 1964, the casino was, some people coming back from the casino were raided by some very clever burglars, robbers, and they stole $750,000 worth of stuff off them, including a big diamond ring or something. And so I think that really put Hunterton Hartford off the idea. They were returning back to Hunterton Hartford's resort. So I think he when he got depressed about something, he was also usually drug addled at the same time, because by this point he was just hookers, beer, drugs, wine, only the best food. He had gone past his, like, his stage with Marjorie Steele had been one of the more important periods of his life, where he got to really be with, he said later on that it was his favorite wife, you know, and I think
that's nice of him.
Yeah, it was very nice of him. Jamie just treated us so bad, but anyway, but by 60, they were divorced. She actually was about to get a load of his money and then signed that away when she married. She there was some sort of clause that she signed saying that she would lose all of her right to money off him if she chose to get married again anytime in the next so many years. And she got married nearly straight away afterwards. She was just like, she met someone else and went off with them. And so he was kind of like, after that rock and roll, he was the people who were attracted to hanging around with George Hunterton Hartford II through this period of history, through the probably through the mid-60s and the 70s, were people who were rock and roll stars and models and other people who were on the New York scene. And it became a party house, and he lived that life, bought everybody drugs and stuff all the time, until basically last of his money had to be put into a trust. He had to be looked after eventually by his daughter. His daughter, who, I think this is his first daughter, from, out of wed, the one he,
first daughter of,
cheated on the wife with. Yeah. I can't remember what her name is. I think it's maybe Juliet, Hartford, Hunterton Hartford. But she, claims to have slept with loads of these people who were hanging around with George Hunterton Hartford II from when she was about 13, 14 years old. Oh. And she seems extremely sexualized, including, she said she slept with Mick Jagger. Now, whether that's why, while she was that age or not, I don't know yet, because I haven't been able to work out what date she says that happened. She just said that she had had sexual relations on multiple times, but also says that she started having sex at these sort of like soirees her dad was putting on by the time she was like 13, 14. Good. So there's obviously, well, there's obviously a lot of like, if you live in the party scene, if you live in the party world, then, you know, you could be sexualized young. What that means, and who she was sexualized by, I do not know. I just don't know, but it seems like it fits in with her father's sort of image of the world, which is nothing really matters. It's party time forever. Mummy and daddy didn't love me properly, and I'm very sad. The difference between George Huntington Hartford II and Jeffrey Epstein is really clear, being that George Huntington Hartford II died of old age. So he got away with everything he did.
Was he blackmailing people?
I think there's a lot more. I tried to tell, because when I read the stories about George Huntington Hartford, like most people, you can get really annoyed and frustrated by how sanitized they are. When someone's already dead, why are you writing a sanitized article when there's obviously more there? Why are you doing it? Who are you trying to please? But this is what was out there. So in these sort of things, there's lots of sanitization by other researchers. But I think there's a lot more. I think he was trying to do. I think if he had tried to blackmail people, he would have failed at that too. So it really, his story is truly one of a man who has the biggest silver spoon, the most amazing trust fund, all of the opportunities in life, all of the ability to be someone fantastically interesting and talented, and fails at absolutely every single thing he does in spectacular fashion. Wow. I think that is like a life with, is that a life worth leading? I don't know. but it is one of those stories in the world where everything, like, if you can, I could, it's interesting, there's so many matches to Jeffrey Epstein itself, but I think the real point of that is you could be this unlucky and this lucky at the same time.
Yeah. That's crazy. It's an interesting guy. These connections to Ian Fleming and James Bond series are, you know, I guess not surprising, really. I look at that whole area out there. We've got Peter Nygaard, we've got Richard Branson, we've got Epstein, we've got a lot of guys with islands out in the Caribbean doing up to no good. But let's wrap up with this one last question, which is kind of sort of connected, but with regard to Jeffrey Epstein, what do you think he was up to in New Mexico?
Okay, because
that was a weird angle. This brought in, you know, we understand the politicians and getting them in trouble. He pivots somewhere along the way and starts to get really interested in physics and science, starts hanging out with guys like Martin Nowak, starts talking about evolutionary dynamics and evolutionary biology, which is code for eugenics. He starts doing some sort of weird breeding program in New Mexico, and then it goes away and we never hear anything about it. What was this dude up to at that Big Zorro Ranch?
Yeah, I think even the people in the Big Zorro Ranch who were actually looking after the land and stuff seem a little bit like puzzled. And I mean, what I've learned over the past 6 months, especially about the Jeffrey Epstein case, is that not one thing you think is the way it is the way it is. it's
great.
It's an amazingly interesting case that just keeps on. It's a case that keeps on giving and keeps on morphing and keeps on changing, because what we got given, what we got fed by for years and years, is on purpose and is a narrative set up. So I think that with the Zorro Ranch, especially, it was really easy to get people thinking about what he was up to, because at the same time, the Edge stuff, he was so, because at one point he was just the only person funding that Edge Foundation's stuff. And that had some people, I mean, even nowadays, like people like Eric Weinstein and stuff have to like go, well, I just turned up with blah, 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 blah. But he knows where he was, and he knows he's denied he's met him before, and all of this, you know, you still catch these scientists with their pants down, because he was catching the scientists with their pants down. These scientists were desperate for some attention, like always. And as soon as this rich guy come along and said, everybody can stay in my hotel and blah, 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 and he Huntington Hartford it is, you know, gave him everything they want. Then they all came and went, oh my God, you're so wonderful. Now that gave him kudos, and that gave him the ability to get into certain other people. He didn't have to get into everybody. And I don't think he cared about too much about science. He cared about the people who came along with that and the opportunities in the future if they show themselves. So by this point, especially when you're getting in the late 90s and early noughties, what you've got is people who are predicting stuff. The people who are predicting stuff that we don't listen to until much later on are telling all of these rich folk like Jeffrey Epstein, you need to get into nanotech. You need to get into anything that's medical. You need to do all of this. I did an article on David Shaw, D.E. Shaw, who set up one of the biggest hedge funds around the world and employed Jeff Bezos, and then worked Jeff Bezos up until vice president. And then eventually, I think he was co-president the organization, which was had 5% of the New York Stock Exchange at that time under its control. Whoa. It was such a rich... Yeah, I know.
Massive. What's the name of the hedge fund?
D.E. Shaw, David Shaw's head fund. And so Jeff Bezos gets put into Amazon through David. He goes up to Big Papa David Shaw and says, can I go and work for Amazon now? And David Shaw goes, oh, yes, you can go work for Amazon now. And he's like, oh, thank you, Red Dam. And then they go into their station wagon and they set up Amazon, and it's a dream. And it's not, it's from a big hedge fund. But D.E. Shaw, in around that same era as Epstein's flipping over to science, he's also doing the same. He's leaving behind being in a hedge fund and doing all the financial, what he was doing, which was computational sort of game theory and stuff to try and work out what's going to happen in the market. To get out of that, to go to the next big thing, he went into pharmaceuticals and become a fully fledged biomedical chemist. He completely working on stuff that he's selling now to the big dogs, and is all experimental and includes all of the RNA and DNA stuff that we hear so much about. These people who know what's going to happen beforehand have listened to certain people. And so Jeffrey Epstein in the late 90s and early noughties gathered a lot of scientists around him and asked them all over and over again what he needs to do to be big. In a sense, he's asking what he needs to do to remain big and remain a big dog and to be on the frontier of whatever comes next, whatever big thing comes next. So I think there's an element to that to Zora Ranch, and one of the big elements is that there's been a lot of stuff that's thrown in afterwards about breeding stuff, breeding chambers and all this sort of stuff that I've not seen any evidence of, and I doubt the claims of to some extent. And I will write out that properly in a few months, because I am about to release I'm trying to finish off the third right now. It's very hard, so actually it was just going to be one article. Heavily relates to the Epstein case, relates to a lot of the people involved in it, and the veracity of some of the claims. And I found the evidence that flips a lot of it on its head, like really, really does cause, it will cause people to, I've said in a couple of interviews now, could cause the collapse of the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, because it's that serious. And really, it was going to be a one article. There's so much information. It's now a trilogy. And it is, I've never written anything like this. I didn't think that anything like this, that I would be able to find anything like this. This has come to me after years of working on the case. I think there's going to be a lot over the next few years. You've already heard some of the main people in the case start to change stories. You know, the fact that they dropped all the charges, or they dropped all the accusations against Dershowitz, is a really strange one. Did anybody see that coming? Now, you go back through history of the case, and you start to see something forming, and you see how things form. And if you've got certain information, you'll start to see a really grand pattern, and who is the puppet master behind this grand pattern. The one main puppet master who has made not only the Epstein case disappear, but many other.
God, you know how to sell the shit out of it, don't you?
Oh, well, this is an easy one to sell. This is like the candy floss of investigation.
Where's the best place for people to find your outstanding and remarkable work?
You're so nice to me, Charles. I'm at johnnyvedmore.com. I've just changed it round, so it's easier to use. Johnnyvedmore.com is one of the main places. I have got funkymonkey.com, but I kind of like, it's just turning into johnnyvedmore.com. And I kind of like Fungi Monkey. If you type in Fungi Monkey onto any video platform, is a good way to find me if they've scuppered my name somehow, if they've made it so you, because this happens in Chile, for instance. At times I've said to people, okay, you can find, look on YouTube, and they put in my name and there's nothing on there. There's nothing on there. And I'm standing there going, no, I'm telling you the truth. I really do. And there's nothing on your phone. So it looks like I'm lying. What can I say? You know, I've also used Fungi Monkey. But I would say, yeah, you know, support Unlimited Hangout. Hopefully I'll be writing a little bit more for UK column news. But the most important thing is, please come support work like this. JohnnyVedmore.com. There's a place for you people to support. I have avoided asking for support from people for a long time, but damn, life is hard nowadays, and I got a lot of investigations to get through, loads of investigations, so I can't risk having to get a part-time job. I gotta expose the world. One thing I'd say is that thanks to everybody for coming and reading. Anybody who does, enjoy. I hope you enjoy, and just thanks.
I hope you put your, I hope people out there support this work. It's not the type. This is not the line of work where the BBC gives you a nice six-figure deal to write for them. You are the enemy of them. They view you with contempt. We think you're fantastic, though. We think you're fucking amazing. But if you like his work, please support it. And if you have more, if you've got more money than time, send some money his way. If you've got more time than money, share the shit out of his work with the people around you. That helps too. That helps to get the word out.
And if you want to get involved, if you want to help me with something, with a project, anybody out there who wants to actually just say like, oh, I could do a bit of research of this or a little bit of research on that, I can give you something to research the hell out of, and you can help me in whatever way is possible, because we got to sort this mess out. That's it.
That we certainly do. That's Johnny Vedmore, everybody. One of the best investigative journalists in the world working right now. If you like this episode, you can take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can follow me on Twitter at Macroaggression and the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you again soon.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is Matt Rogers from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.